Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, this is Marcy Cheek, and this is my show, Say What? Where? When? And most importantly, why? I've been asking why my whole life. My mother said it was the first word I ever spoke. You know, not mama or dada, but why? Because much of what has happened in my early life, I just simply did not understand at all. Did not make any sense to me. And I would say, well, why? Why? My mother said I drove her crazy. And finally, she just would say, because I said so. Well, I wasn't able to accept that either. So from the earliest memories, I was looking into things. We didn't have the internet in those days, but we had libraries, and anytime I was with someone that I felt could give me some information, I would ask a million questions. I've been asking those questions forever. And so we've been talking on my show about weddings, because that's for the last 18 years what I've been doing, is doing beach weddings, weddings at the beach in beautiful Laguna Beach, California. I welcome you getting in touch with me if you have any questions about your wedding, or if you've been thinking about having a beach wedding. It's not exactly the same kind of a wedding that you would have at a church or at a hotel. It has some elements to it that you need to be aware of. So you can always email me. My email is mcheek0509@AOL. A lot of you will recognize that as an old email address. I've had that email since 1997, and it is just so out there that I just wouldn't have any idea how to go about changing it to a more modern address. So I'm just sticking with the old. It's my M is for Marcy, and Cheek is my last name. Cheek, like dancing cheek to cheek. And 0509 is my birthday. So mcheek0509@AOL. Just give me a holler. Let's talk about your wedding. If you have any questions about getting married, or if you're with Mr. Wright, I have written a book to help you with this, with some worksheets and some ways of knowing a little bit more about yourself, as well as giving some thought to this person that you think you might like to spend the rest of your life with. And you can download my book for free at www.MrWright, and that's MRRIGHT, the abbreviation for Mr. MR, Mr. Wright, for me. And that's FOR, not the letter, number, Mr. Wright, for, FORME.com. My book is in all the libraries here in Orange County, California, where I live, but it's also in all the libraries in New York City, Chicago, and Los Angeles, the three major cities in the United States. So you can download the book, do the worksheets, and find out a lot of information about yourself and Mr. Wright. Is he Mr. Wright? So today we're going to look at wedding traditions. Have you ever wondered why we do the things at weddings? Of course, you'd know I would ask why, right? Why does the father give the bride away? Why does the bride wear a veil? Why do we exchange rings? Why do we feed each other cake? Why do we toss the bouquet and the garter? Why do we throw rice? Where have all these traditions come from? When did they start? And what do they mean? So let's just look into this. Did you know that the original word for bride meant to cook? And the word for groom came from a word that meant male child. Tradition really is such an interesting part of our lives. We continue doing things long after we even know the reason why it was done in the first place. I met a groom who was Catholic who was marrying a bride who was Jewish. And it was easy to choose the tradition for the Catholic boy. I just said the Our Father for him and did the sign of the cross. But the Jewish girl, I asked her what she would like to do, and she said, well, we always break the glass at our weddings, so I think I would like to do that. I said, all right. Well, a couple days later, she called me, and she said, I told my mom and dad I wanted to break the glass at the wedding, and neither one of my parents know why we do this. Do you know why? She asked the right person, didn't she? Of course I know why. Well, when I was getting my ordination, of course I studied the Jewish history. And I know the real reason why Jewish people break the glass. And it had to do with the temple being destroyed in Jerusalem in 70 AD, which was the outward visible sign of the Jewish people as a nation. And at that time, that's when the Jewish people were dispersed all over the earth. And they began to break the glass at that time to continue to remind them that even though the temple was destroyed, no matter where they were on the earth, they were still God's people, and they were still a nation in spirit. Of course, the nation of Israel was reestablished in 1948, according to prophecy, and it came to pass. But they still break the glass because of tradition. But I decided to do some little extra personal research because I live in a retirement community that is about 55% Jewish at that time. And I go to the pool and swim about four times a week. And a lot of the people in the pool were Jewish. So I started asking all of them, why do you break the glass? Well, you know what? Every single person gave me a different answer. So 2,000 years later, they don't even know why they do it, but they love to do it, and they shout, Mazel Tov! And so I told my bride this, and I said, but I have written a little special thing I say to break the glass, and I say that in the when we're launching a ship for its first voyage on the great ocean, the great sea of life, we break a bottle of champagne over the bow of the ship. And so today, as we send forth bride and groom out on that great sea of life together, we're going to break the glass. And in this way, we will send them forth with all of our blessings and our well wishes for them to have a long and happy married life. And that's what we did, and afterwards we all shouted Mazel Tov, and it was great. So let's look at some of these other traditions. Let's look at the father giving away the bride. Where did this come from? And do you still want to do this at your wedding? I have brides that are being married for the second and sometimes even the third time being given away by their father. I have to tell you, I am leading a one-woman crusade to eliminate this wedding custom. However, it is a very strong tradition, and I perhaps won't see it eliminated in my lifetime, unless, of course, I can enlist all of your help, and then we could perhaps change this tradition. This tradition goes back in time in history when a woman was merely chattel to be bargained for. The woman belonged to the community, and her purpose was to provide the man comfort and to bear his children. The tribal leader gave his consent for her purchase and decreed to whom she could belong. Originally, and then later on, this consent was passed from the tribal leader to the girl's father. So as religions began to develop among the various cultures then, the consensus of society in general was that a man and woman's sexual behavior should be regulated by marriage. And it was an unwritten law that the man would not always necessarily need to be monogamous. Most cultures in the world implicitly support monogamy for women, but men can take as many lovers as they want, including other men. It was, however, very important for any children to be born within the confines and protection of marriage, as economic and inheritance considerations were involved. So in early times, long before DNA testing, the reason that bed sheets with the blood on them were hung outside the wedding chamber after the first marriage night was to prove to the world that the marriage had been consummated and that the woman had been a virgin. And any child born of that cohabitation would unquestionably be the groom's child. Now, this agreement between the father of the groom and the father of the bride very often was to unite kingdoms, to make a clan or a tribe or a family stronger against any adversaries. And sometimes it was to gain additional lands for farming or forestry that could serve as a buffer for safety purposes to lands that were already owned. And although even in primitive times and in all cultures of the world, there have been couples who fall in love and convince the powers to be to let them marry, the father of the bride still negotiated a fee for his daughter's purchase. Now, the verb to husband means to farm. To farm, that's what a husband means. To take care of the land, to tend to the affairs of the land. So a husband is basically a landowner or a farmer. And since the woman went with the whatever bargain had been struck between the fathers, a bargain that almost always included the land, the woman was husband. She went with the land. She went from being her father's daughter to being a husband's wife with no identity of her own other than having the womb that would produce children and run the home. So now let's look at the tradition of the past. Remember those old-fashioned vows in which a woman promised to obey? You know what? I think I really said that when I got married. And I recently had a bride who wanted to promise to obey her husband in the marriage ceremony. And I asked her why she wanted to make this promise. And she said that her Christian church had taught her that she had to obey her husband. So I want to say something about that. As you know, I'm untraditionally ordained. I did my ordination through a small university, which did not reflect any specific religious faith. We studied all the religions of the world and all the esoteric thought systems of the world. And actually, for 2 years, I studied under a professor of a small college in northern Indiana, whose book had been is used in all of the seminaries across the country in all the different denominations about the Old Testament and the prophets. His name was Dr. Hobart Freeman, and he was fluent in the Greek and Hebrew, and he could read the manuscripts in their original. And he taught us what the Bible really said. I don't want to burst anybody's bubble, but what the church teaches us today and has down through the centuries since 320 AD is not what the Bible was, not what the original manuscripts say. So let's look at this women obey your husbands thing. First of all, that was written in the Middle East when women were not allowed to be seen in public, could not sit in church with their husband, and could not teach a man. Many Christian churches today still do say that the woman has to submit to the man. And I heard it preached one time from the pulpit. I couldn't believe my ears what I was hearing. And this well-meaning pastor said from the pulpit that if a woman is married to a man and if he beats her or slaps her around, knocks her around the kitchen, or is unfaithful to her, that she is to trust the Lord to change things for her. And the scripture the pastor used to preach this was, "Women, submit yourselves to your husbands in the Lord." And that's how he had interpreted it. Well, let's look at those last three words, "in the Lord." That meant the husband, you trust a husband who's in the Lord. You don't trust in the Lord to protect you when he's beating you up. So the in the Lord, a husband that's in the Lord would be a godly man. And certainly a man who beats his wife or cheats on her is not a godly man. A woman needs to run as fast as she can to get away from a man like that. Never to consider a person like this as a potential or real husband. However, subordination of women has a long history. In doing my research on how women have been considered to be sub-creatures, as late as 1954 in London, the newspaper reported that there were only about 20 murders a year now in London. This is 1954. And not all of them are serious. Some of them are just husbands killing their wives. So they didn't consider that serious. The Quran does say, however, that men have authority over women because Allah has made the one superior to the other. How about that? And in China, before 1980, despite new laws designed to protect women there, a husband could still legally beat and torture his wife. And even Mr. Shakespeare in The Taming of the Shrew said, "Thy husband is thy lord, thy life, thy keeper, thy head, thy sovereign." However, if you remember the lady in that story was not a submissive woman. That's why they called her the shrew. They're just trying to get some control over her by telling her, submit, submit, submit. The truth is, however, that spiritually men and women are co-creators. Each one is made in the image and likeness of God and placed on earth in equal dominion over all of the other kingdoms, the mineral kingdom, the plant kingdom, and the animal kingdom. The Bible clearly states the dominion was given unto them, not him. The dominion was given unto them. Well, today, the clearer understanding of the true roles of male and female are that a woman chooses her own partner in life, and she's not bargained for. So it seems to me that a woman who still wants to be given away in the marriage ceremony by her father is inextricably tied to the past history of woman's suppression. And so I think we need to look at that. However, there are a lot of women today that are still looking for a husband in the sense that they just want to be taken care of. They don't want to work. They want to go from their daddy to their husband and have the husband take care of them like he takes care of his own personal life, which so that is in the true understanding of the word husband. However, there are 21st century brides that could perhaps consider a new word for husband. Let's think about that. I would love to have you email me at mcheek0509 and let me know what kind of wording you would like to have. How about partner in life or true love or companion, twin flame, soulmate, fellow traveler along the road of life? Please let me know what words you would like to use instead of husband. Or if you still want to use the word husband, and tell me why you would like to still use the word husband. I'm very interested to know about this. I do offer a 21st century non-religious, non-cultural, emancipated presentation of the bride in my ceremony. I think the brides can still be walked down the aisle by her dad. There is a certain transfer here because the father has been the main man in the woman, in a daughter's life until she takes on her marriage. And there's a lovely moment there where the father can take his daughter's hand and place it in the hand of the husband-to-be. Plus, I think a woman can walk more like a lady, especially if she's in high heels, walk down the aisle on the arm of a gentleman. So then I ask, who stands with you today? I ask the bride, who stands with you today? And she'll say, you know, my dad or my father or whatever word she uses. And then I'll ask the dad, is this a happy day for you? And these dads, you know, it's kind of a bittersweet moment for them. This is their precious baby that they're now handing over to somebody else. Authority and they I've had a father say, bittersweet,
you know, it's a bittersweet day, sad and happy. And I've had him say that. Well, it's, I'm happy and sad at the same time. And then some dads say, yes, it's a happy day. It's about time. And then I ask them if they agree with and support their daughter's decision to be married to the groom. I think it's good to have a public declaration of that, that the family is in support of this union. Family support is important for a marriage. If you've got a parent that's interfering and still wanting, you know, doesn't recognize the new relationship, the Bible says the man must leave his mother and father and cleave only unto his wife. And there's a good reason for that suggestion. The mother of the man has to relinquish that person to the wife. Otherwise, she can cause an interference there. And also, the mother of the bride sometimes can still put a lot of pressure and want to try to still be an influence in the bride's life to where it interferes with the bride and the groom beginning to make their own connection to each other and look to one another for their love and support. I really admire the Jewish presentation of the bride and groom, and I encourage all of my couples to consider it, because in the Jewish tradition, the mother, the father, and the mother of the bride, and the father and the mother of the groom present their children for marriage. And when I think that's just great. I mean, it takes two to tango, right? So, whether the my couple is Jewish or not, I suggest they do this, and that I will announce the groom, and his parents bring him in, and then I announce the bride. I have everybody stand, and her parents bring her in, and it's very dramatic and meaningful, and then it's very nice afterwards to have a thank you to those parents. I did a Persian wedding one time with and they just have a grand and glorious presentation of the bride and groom. The couple is walked into the marriage ceremony location by all of their relatives. And in the history of this, all the dogs and camels and donkeys and all the other animals and accompanied them, and they beat drums and play other musical instruments, and they sing and chant and clap their hands. And there can be, in the case when the one that I did, there was like almost 100 people that brought in the groom, and then 100 people that brought in the bride, and they crowd around them, and they walk in teeny tiny little steps together, you know. So I had a couple recently who wanted to do this, and they walked in beating drums, they rang bells, they carried flags and balloons and banners, and the guests just loved this wedding, and the invitation told what they were going to do and invited the guests to bring their own noisemakers and ways of celebrating.
So the reason why pastors and priests and rabbis today who say, who gives this woman to be married to this man, is because there's been nothing paid for her today. Although the engagement ring is connected to this original payment, and we will talk about that next week. But I've had brides brought in and walked down the aisle by any number of different types of people and friends and family. And so some of them are, in second marriages particularly, brides are usually walked in by a son or daughter. or both of her children on either side, or if a bride has three children and two girls and a boy, then she'll have the boy walk her in, and the girls usually are bridesmaids, junior bridesmaids, or sometimes even a maid of honor. I've had them walked in by their boss, by a sister, by a brother, by an uncle, by a grandfather, lots of grandfathers, by a stepfather, by the father and the stepfather. I had one bride have her stepfather, her real father, walked her from the limo to the start of the aisle, and then she had her stepfather walk her down the aisle because that's who she had actually lived her life with. And sometimes there just isn't a father anywhere, and so the bride chooses to have her mother walk her down the aisle. But lots of mothers bring their daughters to me. And one of my brides said, "My mother is walking me down the aisle. My father doesn't deserve the privilege." And then many brides walk in alone, just strong in their own identity, proud of their choice of their man. One of my brides walked in alone while the guests rang bells, and she had this little bellboy precede her down the aisle and ringing his bell and saying, "The bride is coming! The bride is coming!" And then all the guests stood up and rang their bells. So now let's look at wearing the veil, because wearing the veil does go back to the ages past, when the bride was negotiated for and purchased, and the woman couldn't be seen in public. And the bride and groom did not know each other, had never even seen each other. The bride would be covered from head to toe in her father's home, and then she would be delivered to her husband, who would then take her into his home. And then, and though only then, would she be uncovered in the privacy of the home, just for the groom's eyes alone. Well, this veiling custom was what allowed Laban in the Bible to pass off his eldest daughter, Leah, first in the story of Jacob and Rachel. It's a wonderful story. Jacob was out tending to his sheep, and he saw this beautiful girl over by the well, drawing water up out of the well, and he instantly fell in love. So he found out who she was, and he went to her father and asked for her hand in marriage. And so her father said, "Okay, if you work for me for 7 years, you can have her." So Jacob, the Bible says Jacob worked in with joy in his heart. Isn't that sweet? Every day he worked 365 days a year for 7 years. Get this girl. So they had the ceremony, and the father brought the heavily veiled woman to him, and he took her into his tent and unveiled her, and it wasn't Rachel. It was her older sister, Leah. Because there also was a tradition in those days that the second daughter couldn't be married until the first daughter was married. So, Jacob went back to the father and he said, "What is this?" He said, "This isn't Rachel. I want Rachel." So the father said, "Okay, if you'll work for me for 7 more years, I'll give you Rachel." Because they could have more than one wife in those days. So he worked again another 7 years, and he finally was able to be with his true love. Can you imagine one man being married to sisters? I mean, gosh, women had to really be in submission in those days, couldn't they? They couldn't open their mouths. So the veil denoted chastity and modesty and indicated that a woman was in submission to the man and that she actually was less than the man, not only weaker, but dumber. And that is in the Quran, that the woman is weaker, she's dumber, she's less than the man, and she still is veiled in those in the east, in those eastern countries. They can just see the eyes, see where they're going. Well, and the word veil means concealment, to disguise, to hide, to seclude oneself. It also means indistinct and vague. Well, just to think about it then, none of these meanings should even be considered between a relationship, in a relationship between a man and a woman who are entering into the most intimate and personal union that can be experienced in mortal existence. Vague? Disguised? That sure sounds like a hidden agenda, doesn't it? Well, these matters do involve individual choices, and I want to say that no matter what my bride wants to do, she does it. The bride is the boss for me. I'm the servant, and we discuss all these things, but the bride makes the final decision. And I do find that a lot of my brides still attach a certain mystical romanticism to wearing a veil. And they want their husband to lift the veil to claim them. I have noticed, though, in on weddings that I coordinate where they have their own pastor, that if the bride is veiled, they leave that veil on during the entire time they're saying their vows. And the man doesn't lift it until it's time to kiss. And I do have a problem with that. I at one of my weddings, I said, the bride was veiled, and I said to the groom, I said, you may go and take your bride's hand and please unveil her and see if she is the woman that you want. And the guests all laughed and thought that was fun, but once the woman is presented to the man, to the groom, once the bride is presented to the groom, that she should be unveiled. Early part of my wedding business, before it became full-time, I worked part-time at a bank. And one of the girls that I worked with there knew that I was a minister and did weddings, and one day she asked to speak to me privately. She was born in the Middle East, in Afghanistan, and she revealed to me that her marriage had been arranged by her father and that she had not known the man before the marriage. She was considered a prize in her country because her dad was very wealthy. And not only was a substantial fee paid for her purchase, but her dad also funded a huge wedding. She said her father allowed her to look at the pictures of the five men that he had chosen that he felt was worthy for her. And kindly he said that she should see if she felt anything for any one of them. And so she said she picked the one man of the five who looked kind, like her dad. Her dad was very loving and very kind. So she thought this one picture looked like a man who would be like her dad. He was not the wealthiest of the five, although all five of the men were of considerable means. But so they were then married, and they lived in Afghanistan for several years before moving to the United States. Well, once she got here, she began to observe the cultural ways of America, where in freedom we're allowed to choose our own husband using the natural laws of love and attraction. She began to have some different ideas, and she was starting to yearn for a child. And she told me she didn't know if she was in love with her husband, and she wanted to. She said, "I know I love him, but I want to be in love with the man that I have a baby with." So we discussed some of her options. Her aunt also lived here, So she decided to separate from her husband and go live with her aunt for a while and create some personal space for contemplation and soul searching. She continued working at the bank part-time and going to college. And during the next 6 months, her husband began to court her. He called and invited her to go to dinner. He sent her flowers at the bank. We all enjoyed them. He took her dancing, and he bought her all kinds of expensive presents. And all those things that go, you know, with romance. And during the 6 months, she began to realize that she did love her husband. But their time of romancing allowed her to fall in love with him. And she found she wanted to have his baby. Now, this girl was heavily veiled at her marriage. That veil was representing thousands of years of bondage and submission for women. And now she has figuratively been unveiled at last. She's free now, an American citizen, and she is happy and getting ready for the birth of her first child with a man she truly loves. So for the 21st century bride, we can think of the bridal veil in terms of being a beautiful headpiece designed to enhance the full face and the beauty of the bride. Now, I also wanted to talk about all the bridesmaids being dressed alike. Because surprisingly, all of my research into these traditions were concerned with ancient ideas regarding evil spirits. Because from the beginning, when man first was Homo sapiens, you know, he went from the ape to becoming a man. He experienced accidents and sickness and death, and so for whatever a man couldn't see or control, they blamed the unseen. And since these things that happened were usually bad things, they called them the bad spirits, the evil spirits, the unseen forces that worked against them. And then man tried to begin to make up ways to confound or confuse these evil spirits who were accused of creating all this mischief. Now, the bride carries the womb. We as women have the womb. And that has been the number one and most important part of us for a long time. Without us, there is no more human race, you know. We have the babies. But the womb was historically considered the man's property because that was going to bring forth the son who would carry on the family dynasty and inherit the family fortune, and sons who would become civil leaders or the priests. The bride could also have lowly daughters, but those daughters would also become instruments for the births of sons who would become heirs and kings and priests. So the tradition of the bridesmaids all dressing alike was to bring confusion to the evil spirits who would try to find the bride and hurt her and cause her to stumble and injure herself and injure the womb. Because remember, as we discussed, marriages would bring together kingdoms. Marriage would bring two families together, and now they were twice as strong against the enemies. And so the evil spirits of the enemies would come and try to keep that woman from having a son, and then that way the kingdoms would be less powerful. So the bridesmaids dressed all alike, and they would encircle around the bride
and then they would make it impossible for the evil spirits to find her. Well, we don't need to continue to confound evil spirits. And it's okay for the bridesmaids all to be dressed alike. I see the pictures week in and week out, the beautiful color schemes that brides choose. And actually, my son and his wife were they're race fans, and they love the checkered flag. And so they did a black and white wedding, and the bridesmaids were all dressed in black, and the men were all dressed in black. And then my son and his wife were dressed in white. It was very dramatic. I'd never seen it before, but I've seen it a lot since. So, but I wanted to tell you about Elizabeth, because she was truly a 21st century bride back in the 20th century. Because when we met, she said, "I have 10 best girlfriends, and there's just no way I could possibly choose only one of them to be my maid of honor. And I also don't want the girls to have the expense of being bridesmaids. But I wish to honor them each individually during my wedding ceremony." So this is what she suggested and asked me if I thought it would be okay. And of course, I tell her, just like I tell you and every other bride I ever work with, there are no rules or regulations. There's just traditions. But nothing has to ever be done the same way twice. So this is what we did. Each one of the girls chose a different outfit, something that would represent what her relationship was with the bride. And we lined them all up along the aisle that Elizabeth was going to walk down, and each one of them held a red rose. One girl just wore simple beach clothes because she was Elizabeth's best beach buddy. So as the bride entered and walked down the aisle, she stood a few seconds with each girl, and I gave a one or two sentence description of how the bride and the friends met. So I mentioned something about their relationship that contributed to the bride's evolution and preparation for being married. So, like one of them, "Ellen helped me write the term paper that allowed me to graduate from college." "Jane introduced me to the groom. And I've known Jennifer since I was 6 months old." So we had something that we said about each one. And then each girl gave Elizabeth her long-stemmed red rose. And by the time she got to the altar, she had this beautiful bouquet of 10 long-stemmed red roses. And then right before the marriage vows, we did the thank you to the mothers, and we gave 5 of the roses to the groom's mother and 5 of the roses to the bride's mother. So, whatever you've hoped and dreamed about for your wedding, anything is possible, all things. And there are lots of ideas that perhaps you have that maybe has never been done before that you can do at your wedding. And just know that guests love a wedding. They don't come expecting anything. They come just to enjoy. I always tell a bride that's getting really tense before the wedding day, and she's going over all her list and wanting to make sure of this and that. I say, you know what? Your guests don't have any idea what you've planned. They're just going to come and enjoy, and they're not going to know whether everything went exactly the way you have it on this list or not. So set it all up and then trust your professionals. We do this every week. You're doing it once. We do it. I did 143 weddings last year. So I had done 208 the year before. I decided I just couldn't do that anymore. So we know what we're doing, and we can keep everything going perfectly for you, no matter what happens. And I'll tell you some of those stories in 2 weeks. Next week, we're going to do the cutting of the cake and the rings and children, having children in the wedding. Oh, I want to thank you all so much for listening to my show. This is now my 3rd month now. And I just want to give a shout out to Nicholas Snow. He's just been so wonderful. He's on Blog Talk Radio with over 100,000 listeners a month. Can you believe that? 100,000 people a month listen to him. The name of his show is Snow Biz Now. And he currently has a show playing that he lives in Palm Springs, and he went to the Palm Springs Film Festival and walked the red carpet and had an interview with Naomi Watts, which I really recommend that you listen to. She tells her experiences of becoming an actress. You know, nobody starts at the top. And I'm still learning how to do all this technical stuff. I apologize for sometimes all the clicks and not getting it done. We're one-man bands here. I sit in my office and do this show, and I have to work the music and get the microphone going and watch the clock and run the studio all at once. And he was so kind to allow me to come over to Palm Springs and see his studio and see what kind of equipment he used. And that's a person with a very big heart. He's a featured host on Blog Talk Radio, and yet he took his time to help me get started. Thank you, Nicholas. I love you. And my music is by visionarymusic.com. Music that's designed to help and support you in any action that you are taking in your life, a change. Maybe you're making a change in your life. I play this music in my office all the time. It sets up a vibration that allows me to be creative. It allows me to stay focused. And it supports my health and welfare. And I recommend it to you. So that's some more traditions. And next week we will continue in this series. And I welcome you contacting me if you have any questions about your wedding, or if you're still in the process of trying to find Mr. Right. You can download my book at www.mrrightforme.com, and you can email me at mcheek0509@aol.com. And for now, I'm going to say aloha. And aloha is hello, goodbye, and I love you.